From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Kathy Kiley, the Lee Hills Chair in Free Press Studies, sitting in for our regular host, Jason McClure. For this edition of Global Journalist, we have two guests with me in the studio of the Reynolds Journalism Institute. My journalism school colleague, Professor Amy Simons, and Tara Sussman Pena. Tara is based out of Washington, D.C., where she's a senior technical developer at IREX. IREX is a nonprofit with an interesting history that is involved in education and development worldwide. We'll be hearing more about that work in this program. Tara and Amy both just finished training scores of school teachers, college professors, librarians, and members of the Missouri Extension Service. It was all part of Friends of the Facts, a two-day conference we held at the Missouri School of Journalism on improving news literacy. I want them to tell us more about that today. But first, let's define our terms. News literacy, and more broadly, media literacy, have become buzzwords lately. Amy, why is that?
Because one of those things that it's especially post-2016 election, everybody is trying to think about what is news? What are reliable sources of news? Where and how does bias play into it? And people all have their sources that they have come to rely on, to respect, and to trust. Some of them are reliable and respectable and trustworthy. Some of them maybe aren't. And part of developing solid news literacy is to be able to understand what the process is for producing respectable journalism, for sourcing, for asking questions, for looking at facts, for vetting those facts, for providing fairness, not necessarily balance, but fairness. And for the people who are news literate to understand and to develop the skills to be able to know when to question and when to rely and know and understand who's producing the news that they are consuming.
So this has been around for a while. Media literacy has been a field for a while. And what you're saying is since all the conversation about fake news, it's become more of a common parlance
common concern. It's become something where people on each side of the political spectrum, on all of the sides of the political spectrum, want to have ownership of whatever the truth might be. But when we have good, strong news literacy, we have that understanding of where and how bias may slip in. We know where and how different techniques are used to try to maintain a way of spreading news and information that meets standards that we here would consider best practices.
So this is, Amy's talking about this having come up in the wake of the 2016 election, very much obviously a U.S. issue. But Tara, your organization works globally. And I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about what IREX does and how IREX got involved in news literacy or media literacy.
So IREX was founded in 1968 as an initiative of public diplomacy to work with the then Soviet Union. We led exchanges amongst college professors and other higher education professionals. And the idea back then was to build people-to-people relationships, to build more understanding, to build a better understanding of the type of research and scholarship that was going on both sides, despite obvious political differences.
So the X in IREX is exchange.
Yeah. That's right. And we still do exchanges today of many different types in various different places around the world. For example, some of the Fulbright programs that you may have heard of, we run. But we do a number of other things as well. So we started in the Soviet region, and then after the fall of the Soviet Union, the type of work that we did expanded and increased because there was a push toward democratization. So, for example, we began our work in media development around that time. And what that means is supporting all the things that are necessary for a free and an independent, what we would have called press at the time, but now much more broadly, journalistic media. So we work still in those sort of the former Soviet republics, but we also work in about 120 countries around the world. And when in our media work, we do many different things related to increasing access to information, improving the skills of journalists, helping to increase journalist safety, both physically and digitally, as well as self-care for journalists in, under a lot of stress and threat. We also work sometimes with the enabling environment, so the other institutions that support journalism, the legal framework, freedom of the internet, sort of a range of different things, all the things that you can think about in our very complex information system nowadays, we work to help strengthen in various different places around the globe. That's one piece of our work, and the media literacy work grew out of that. We also work, we continue to do educational exchanges, and we also work with civil society organizations in developing and transitioning countries to help them get better as organizations, perform better, and do the good work that their citizens are trying to accomplish, in addition to leadership development, and we have a specialization also in youth. So for us, global development is really the focus on people and on helping people to get better at kind of driving and achieving the goals that they want for their communities.
And so how did you get, or how did IREX get involved in media literacy and where?
Right. So IREX's involvement in media literacy began in Ukraine in 2015. We had already been working in Ukraine for probably about a decade and a half at that point, some of which working with journalists, but also working in the library system. So we had a grant from the Gates Foundation to work across the library system in Ukraine and to modernize it. So both to bring the technology into the 21st century, but also to improve the library's function in society as kind of a community hub, in some ways similar to the kinds of transformations that are happening here in the US. And it was out of that work that we were given a grant by the government of Canada to develop something that was almost like a rapid response to disinformation that was coming in from the Kremlin during the time. This was right after the invasion of Crimea by Russia. And in addition to the physical fighting that was happening, there was a war of information. And this,
so this was a part of Ukraine.
Right.
That had been invaded by Russia and
annexed.
Annexed, yes. And so what was the situation on the ground, and what made the media part of that battlefield?
Right. So as you can imagine, countries on the Russian periphery have been dealing with different forms of propaganda and disinformation on and off in different modes for many, many years. But this was really a ramping up of that. And it was very sophisticated. It was not like sort of the old propaganda of the Soviet era. It was very, very high tech. It was very sleek. It was very appealing to people. It was sometimes in the form of entertainment. It came through their mainstream TV channels, which was at that time something like 80% of Ukrainians got most of their news and information from mainstream TV. So it was kind of everywhere.
Why were the mainstream TV channels in Ukraine willing to put on Russian propaganda?
Well, they were just getting a lot of content from Russia. And so I think there just wasn't so much distinguishing between what was propaganda and what was real news or even real entertainment. A lot of it was entertainment as well. And the media system there is quite different from the one that we have here. Many of the channels are owned by very wealthy businessmen, and the goal is not necessarily to create a more informed public, right? So so this, basically the country was flooded with this information, and we were funded to create a media literacy program that would help people to be able to better distinguish between what was real and what was not real.
And Amy, does that sound familiar to you as somebody who's working with undergraduate college students and high school students
it
when
does.
You say
I'm sitting here just
entertainment kind of indistinguishable from news?
It is. In fact, I teach the class that we have here. We call it a service course. It's the one course that we teach here in the School of Journalism that's offered to students throughout the University of Missouri as an elective to try and get a better understanding of what journalism is and how journalism is done. And the very first thing that I do on the first day of class, it's an online only class, so there are certain parts of this that are done anonymously. I don't know who the students are who are at the time they're submitting this information, what they're submit or who they are that are submitting that, but I ask them what are their top three sources of news and information to get a sense of where it is they think they're getting the information they need to lead their day-to-day lives. And some of the answers that I receive, they are entertainment sources. I'm getting E, I'm getting MTV News, I'm getting whatever the Kardashians are putting on their Instagram. And we do kind of reach a point where we have to talk about the differences between platforms and news sources, or the difference between entertainment and news. In fact, one of the things we have to talk about is ESPN, which is very popular among a lot of the students that I'm teaching, that ESPN is the entertainment sports programming network, that the very first part of ESPN is entertainment, that a lot of the sources of information, I'm not using the word news here, I'm using information, that we are accessing are in that same situation, not there to create a more informed citizenry, but there is, they do become the sources where people are getting the information that is driving their decision-making process.
Well, we have reached a point for me to remind you that if you're just tuning in, this is Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about news literacy with two people who are working to improve it, Professor Amy Simons of the Missouri School of Journalism and Tara Sussman Pena of the global development nonprofit IREX. So, Tara, you said that you were confronted with this situation in Ukraine where the public was being bombarded with propaganda, pro-Russian propaganda, and you were funded to try to combat that. How did you do it?
Right. So I guess first, the propaganda, I would say, is not always take the form of explicitly pro-Russian. A lot of times it sends confusing political messages or polarizing political messages. And at the time it was about the Ukrainian government as much as anything else. So the idea was to create confusion and to create some doubt as to whether there was even possibly such a thing called facts. So again, sort of much more subtle than before.
This sounds like in 2015 you were getting a sneak preview of coming attractions.
Yes,
doesn't
exactly,
it?
Yeah. Exactly. So this is reverberated afterward for sure. So we took a look at the media literacy literature, which has been active in the U.S. for a couple of decades. And there's a lot of really good work on verification and critical thinking, building on journalistic work, but we didn't find anything specifically created around misinformation and disinformation. So we worked with some local experts in Ukraine. We have an office in Ukraine, but also the Academy of Ukrainian Press, as well as an organization called Stop Fake, which was committed to finding and debunking fake news and other types of information. And we put together a curriculum that was specifically around questions of misinformation. So to help people identify hate speech, to help people be able to better identify, discern the difference between false and true information, things as simple as you were saying, Amy, as the difference between fact and opinion.
Mm-hmm.
We actually start there. And we have an important component around creating emotional resilience because
a little bit about what that means.
Yeah.
What does that mean to be, and why do people have to be emotionally resilient when they consume media?
Right. So in the world that we live in, we're just kind of bombarded in this digital age with different kinds of messages and media and information from all sides. Some of it is good, some of it is not good, a lot of it is sort of whatever in between. And so to try and break through the noise, even sometimes good media outlets will put these kind of crazy headlines, right? But there are plenty of bad actors and questionable actors out there that want to try and grab your attention by provoking you, right? So there's a lot of manipulation going on. Some of the manipulation, like in the case of Ukraine, may be for political reasons, but some manipulation may just be to get you to try and buy something or to try and create some sort of chaos. But so this will be using, it could be a headline, it could be a meme, it could be a video, but something that will provoke an emotional reaction. I think anyone who's ever looked at social media probably has an idea of what I'm talking about, right? So you've opened it up and something has like made your hair stand on end. So this is what I'm talking about. And when that happens, there is a biological process that our brain is going through, right? That we're having a fight or flight reaction. We're in survival mode. And when that happens, we actually can't access our rational brain to the full extent anymore. So we need to kind of be able to pause for a moment before we then decide what to do with that information. So that's a piece of what it is that we're teaching, to be able to get access again to that rational, analytical side of your brain, and not just immediately like or share or comment and then perhaps regret it later. I mean, I think, again, most of us may have had experiences with having done this when we got very, very upset about something. Only to later realize, why did I do that? Well, it was because your brain was in survival mode. So this is why this is an important component of the work we do.
And how is this, what made you decide, you've done this work in Ukraine, maybe you can talk a little bit about the impact, but what are you doing here in Missouri?
Right. So in terms of impact, we have been doing some very rigorous evaluation of the work that we've done, because after the first round, saw what we seemed to be very good improvements, but we wanted a more rigorous evaluation of skills building. So we conducted an impact study a year and a half after the initial project was concluded with adults. And we found that the group that we tested the skills of that had gone through the Learn to Discern training had a statistically significant higher level of skill, even a year and a half later, than a demographically matched group of other adults. So we felt like we had enough evidence to go on that there's something here that actually really works. And we were thinking about where we might want to go next. We were considering a number of different countries. And then, as you said, hints of things that happened later, 2016 in the US, we were inundated with all kinds of new types of information. And it seemed to have had an impact on our electoral politics. And so we decided that we would try working in the US. So we've been doing some pilot projects in Arizona, in New Jersey, in Connecticut, and now we're here in Missouri. And we're really excited to be working with adults and of various different types, with teachers, with educators, with librarians, to help kind of bring this to a broader group of people.
Amy, how do you see this dovetailing and what happened overseas dovetailing with what we're doing here? And of course, Tara's group, I think it's fair to say, at least up until this point, has been working primarily with adults, right? Talk about how we're trying to reach out to students at the University of Missouri and why that's important.
So one of the things that we're doing here is trying to reach out to students who are in that young adult age range. We're talking about students who are in their first, second, maybe third year of college, and they are they're on their own for the first time, which means they're in an environment where they are away from family and friends who have influenced their habits or have influenced what they've been reading or watching or listening to their entire lives. This is their opportunity for them in their own to create their own personal bubble away from those other influences that have been a part of their upbringing, and to determine what it is they want to consume. And so what we're doing is really trying to explain to them how news is produced, where, what different sources look like. I go through with them the exact process from story idea generation to interviews to production to publication to understand what goes into making journalism happen. We talk about business models, about ownership, about influences that the business can have on the production itself and how that can have an influence on the information that you receive. And as students begin to really see each of these factors coming into play, you can see in a very short time how some of their habits will change. They will adapt because they begin to become exposed to other sources of news or information where they may not say, okay, I'm going to turn off Fox News and only watch MSNBC. But what they may say is, you know, it might make sense to watch MSNBC for 15 or 20 minutes a day just to hear a different perspective than what it is that I'm used to. It's not to say that one is necessarily good, one is necessarily bad, but to see and to value the sharing of the marketplace of ideas. And if I'm able to do that in 8 weeks with a student, I count that as a win. The opening of a mind to different voices and opening that up.
Amy, you've been talking about what you've been doing to train students. I think it might be important to note you're a professor at the School of Journalism, mm-hmm. but a lot of your students are not journalism majors.
Most of my students, based on what I'm teaching right now, almost all of my students are
not journalism
majors.
So why should a person who doesn't have any intention of becoming a journalist learn about journalism?
Because without learning about journalism, you don't learn how information gets produced, processed, and spread. And if we are going to have an educated society, a knowledgeable society, if we're going to be raising people who have the right to vote when they turn 18 years old, we want them to also know and understand what it is that they're doing when they're making those decisions. And understanding what they're watching on TV, reading on the internet, hearing on the radio, listening to in podcasts that they're choosing to listen to, that where that information comes from and how it's produced and the influences behind that production, that's what drives decision making. And we want people to be making smart decisions. Whatever direction people want to take, have them be informed decisions based in fact.
Tara, Amy has a captive audience. She teaches students who have to get credits. And
yeah, not only are they captive, I have the power of the red pen.
Exactly. And the high school teachers who were with us earlier today also have that advantage. How did IREX, or how are you reaching out to adults? How are you getting people in the room listening to what you have to say?
Right. Well, we're still figuring that out in the U.S., actually. So we're working.
So maybe tell us how it worked in Ukraine
okay.
first.
Okay. Well, in Ukraine, and actually in Ukraine, we've moved into the school system there. So in Ukraine, we worked through the libraries mostly, as well as through educators. Basically, we recruited for citizen trainers, and we looked for people that were very highly motivated and very passionate about this topic. We then trained them, and they went off and independently recruited groups of basically peers to train. Some of this happened in libraries, and while we had some educators, they weren't for the most part teaching their students, but other kinds of peers. And through this kind of peer education, we reached 15,000 people directly in 9 months. And because part of the methodology was to ask people to share what they learned with others, we estimate that we reached about 90,000 people in that period of time. So we really feel that this kind of personal interaction, the trust network, is probably a big piece of why this was very important. And so we're starting to think about this in the U.S. We're also working in several other countries as well, including Tunisia, Guatemala, where else? Iraq, Indonesia, Serbia, the country of Georgia. The list is kind of going on. And this is just the media literacy work that we're doing. So mostly with adult populations, but in Ukraine, we have a relatively newer grant to work in the school system, which is centralized in Ukraine. So we work with the Ministry of Education, and we're embedding these lessons into the curriculum for secondary school students. And similarly, we did some evaluation and found that with the addition of this media literacy into these five different topic areas, that students' skills are testing higher.
I think think Tara raises a really good point, if I can add to this. And you brought this up yesterday, and I then parroted this yesterday, too, in the conversations that we had as part of our conference. One of the things that I think we really need to be doing a better job as we're trying to build news and information literacy is partnering with our libraries, both public libraries, university libraries, especially as we're looking to build trust as journalists and as news organizations, because libraries, they market in information. People don't go to libraries to be misinformed, right? That is all they have is information, and people trust their librarians. And I think the more that we do to partner with libraries, you talked about doing it abroad, I think we need to do even more of that here to increase media and news literacy, both among young children, then older learners, and adults as well.
And I should say that we had at our conference a number of librarians.
Yeah, there were some fist pumps when we brought that up yesterday.
Yes, yes. They all looked pretty excited, and they liked being recognized. Mm-hmm. And we also had members of the Missouri Extension, who are folks who represent the university in rural communities. So I think those kind of trusted sources, I think that's one of the things maybe you could say a little bit more about how important it is, Tara, to get people within a community who have circles of influence.
Right. Well, I think this is why we're in some way trying to keep this train the trainer model, because for me to come in from Washington, D.C. and say, hey, I know everything, let me teach you, like, that is, first of all, ridiculous, and second of all, not going to fly, right? So it's very important that anything we teach is very, very contextually relevant and makes sense to the people that are learning it. And because there's so much mistrust nowadays in information, people don't know that, I think it's very important to work through with and through trusted, we call them infomediaries, so information intermediaries.
Nice. Yeah. Do you either of you have anything that really stood out for you from the conversations you had over the last day and a half, 2 days with the people you met here at the university?
The hunger to keep the conversation going, the hunger for collaboration and to keep the conversation going and to be working towards this common goal. The fact that we've had so many people coming from different corners of the country, different corners of the world, different corners of the state, but each with different interests. The high school teachers, the librarians from both public and university sides, the extension folks. That's the part that's been exciting.
Yes, I think for me it would be related that that it speaks to a real need that people have. I mean, it doesn't matter what you do, you are interacting with information in some ways, and people are carrying around in their pockets these very powerful computers, right, the telephones, that are in some ways dictating what we're doing. So I think people really feel like that it's a real need that we all have to be able to better handle the world that we live in today.
I'm sorry to end this great conversation, but we are out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA, Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Thanks to our assistant producer, Adam Jalon, our director, Travis McMillan, audio engineer, Takia Thomas, and to all the staff of the Missouri School of Journalism who helped make our Friends of the Facts News Literacy Fair a success. If you want information on how you can get news literacy training in your community, email us, newsliteracy@missouri.edu. For all of us at Global Journalist and the Missouri School of Journalism, I'm Kathy Kiley.